At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Yildiz Cruz. Professor Cruz has taught at the University of San Francisco since 1977, serving as History Department Chair and co-chair of several Senate councils. He's taught courses on the histories of Japan and China and U.S. East Asian relations, including U.S.-Japan relations. He received a BA in American and European History from Yale University, a master's in European and East Asian History from Northwestern University, and a PhD in East Asian History from Indiana University. Cruz first went to Japan in 1972 as a Fulbright scholar and taught at Kyoto University in 1973 to 74. His publications and papers include, and this is just a very small sampling of his published works, An Economic History of the Major Capitalist Countries, A Chinese View, Domestic Constituencies in Nixon's China Policy, A New Look from the National Archives, Japan-Iran Relations Since 1979, China-Japan Relations, History and Future Prospects, and San Francisco and the 1951 U.S.-Japan Peace Treaty Conference. He's currently researching and writing a political biography of Shin Kanemaru, 1914 to 1996, The Rise and Fall of a Japanese Shadow Shogun, which is a book-length manuscript of one of contemporary Japan's leading political brokers, Shin Kanemaru, who was influential in Japanese politics in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. I will also note that Dr. Cruz was my favorite graduate school professor when he taught East Asian politics when I was at graduate school at USF. Would you please welcome Yildiz Cruz.
Cynthia, thank you so much. Well, I'm happy to be here today. I'm happy to see a very nice turnout. First of all, I'd like to thank Cynthia very much for inviting me some months ago. I'd also like to give a special thanks to Steve Matsuura for providing the bento lunches for everyone, and also Lillian Nakagawa, who's worked, I think, very indefatigably behind the scenes. So I'm just happy to see all of you here today. What I'd like to do today is talk about the early history of U.S.-Japan relations, and maybe at the end also think somewhat outside the box and speculate and ruminate. I'm trained as a historian. I'm not trained as a futurologist. But based on past experience, what can we possibly anticipate coming out of this relationship? This is the talk title here. I thought of something that would be catchy: when East met West. It's like when Sally met, who was it? So Harry, when Sally met Harry. It's been a long time since I've seen that film. But I didn't mean to make this into a romantic comedy. I really didn't. But there is this kind of interest, which I think really was very palpable when Japanese first came here to the United States and when Americans first went to Japan. Some of it's lurid. Some of it has to do with sexuality. Some of it has to do with power relationships. Some of it just has to do with pure friendship. But it's a very wide scope of all of these things. Now, why is this happening this year? First of all, I think we have to situate this. This is the 150th anniversary of the visit, the very first diplomatic visit of a Japanese embassy to the United States aboard the Kanrinmaru, and also aboard the Powhatan. There were two ships that came to the United States, stopped here in San Francisco, and then proceeded via the Panama Canal onto Washington, D.C. So San Francisco was an important stopover point. So part of the reason for us, when I say us, San Francisco, honoring this was we were a very important stepping stone for that very first delegation. This is a screen capture from the Kanrinmaru website, if any of you would like to go there and take a look. But this is there have been a whole host of events starting back in, in February, March. March 17th was the actual date when the Kanrinmaru actually docked here. So it was 150 years ago. This is taken from an artist's representation of the kind of tough sailing across the North Pacific. And so I'll contrast and compare this to some other images a little bit later on. So keep that in mind. This is kind of the iconic. I mean, the Japanese really wanted to get here really badly. This was not your cruise ship. This was not the Love Boat. This was stormy weather, and the Japanese did it. Now, part of the ceremonies, part of the celebration, was to also bring a similar tall ship to San Francisco. This happened in May of this year. The Kaiwomaru, not the Kaninmaru, but the Kaiwomaru. And it's a very, very impressive visit here. I think I may have left out the Lincoln Park celebration, but I'm not quite sure how all that happened. But anyway, let me talk a little bit about the significance, the larger significance of this. What we're celebrating here and commemorating is and remembering is the origins of the U.S.-Japan relationship, which have become very important for Americans, certainly beginning in the 1920s and 1930s through the 40s, and even more so in the 50s, 60s, and today. So now the U.S.-Japan relationship has become very close since 1951, since the U.S.-Japan peace treaty was signed, and then also the Mutual Security Treaty. We're committed to the security of Japan. It's a very solemn kind of commitment. And Ambassador Mike Mansfield in the early 80s called the U.S.-Japan relationship the most important bilateral relationship in the world. That's been somewhat modified a little bit under the Obama system here, where China is somewhat coming into the picture in this. So there's been some wording here that the U.S.-China relationship also is a very important one, but not more important than anyone else. So there's been some equality that's been kind of garnered in this. A very important point here is that this 150-year history is mostly friendly and cooperative. The part that I think many people tend to remember, of course, is Pearl Harbor. And World War II, and Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and the incarceration of the Japanese Americans during World War II. And there is that phase of the U.S.-Japan relationship, roughly between 1905, between the Russo-Japanese War, when the Japanese obviously were now a major force in the Pacific and in Northeast Asia, and through 1945, when Japan was defeated by this coalition. But if you look at the earlier period from 1868 to 1905 and even beyond, the Japanese really saw a great deal to admire in the United States through liberalism, through art, through philosophy. And then after 1945, especially after 51, the U.S. and Japanese economic systems became very closely integrated. America became a crucial export market for the Japanese. So in 2010, we have a chance to kind of step back and see where it all has, where it's all begun. Some other points here. I think for the Japanese, the effort on the part of sending the Kaninmaru and other expeditions like the Iwakura mission in 1871 was a way to find out more about the world. Japan at that time had largely been cut off from Europe, from the United States, and so on. They did have very strong ties strong contacts with China and with Korea. Recent scholarship tends to emphasize this, with the Dutch. So it wasn't that Japan was completely closed off to outside influences. But the visit of the Kaninmaru represented an effort on the part of the Japanese elite to find out more about the world. It was a reconnaissance. It was an effort to find out as much as they could. And eventually about a third of Japan's elite, the Meiji elite, eventually went abroad, either aboard the Kaninmaru or the Iwakura mission, which went in 1871 through 73 and so on. So basically they wanted to gain firsthand knowledge, not just read about it, but to really find out. And how to cope with the foreign powers, not only how to cope with them in terms of power, and there's a very real power relationship here. The Japanese were very much aware of it, and the Americans were very much aware of it. This is not, I don't mean to make this into a Disneyland kind of event for you where everybody is getting along very, very, very well. But it was also an effort made to find out the source of European and American wealth and power. What is it that has brought about these civilizations, the European civilizations in America? What has enabled their people to be in some ways wealthier, more advanced? Now, the ultimate culmination of all of this is regime change in Japan, where the modernizers, in effect, push aside the old feudal shogunate system in 1868, an event called the Meiji Restoration. That's a very complicated process, and we don't need to necessarily go there, but it's something that's important. Another factor that I think tends to get overlooked is this is really also the origins of the U.S.-Japan or the Japanese-American community in the United States. Beginning in the 1860s, a number of sailors from the Kanrin Maru did not survive the trip. They're buried here in Colma. So it's not a living community, but this was the start. Now, most Japanese, when they came to the United States, actually went to Hawaii, which in that time was an independent kingdom. It's only after 1893 that the Hawaiian kingdom is extinguished with Queen Liliuokalani, and the Americans also get involved in a little bit of regime change there, and Hawaii actually becomes then American territory. So it's only in the 1890s, after Hawaii becomes an American territory, that large numbers of Japanese start to come to California. But the Kanrin Maru, in a way, symbolizes the start of this Japanese-American community. And the Japanese-American community, like the U.S.-Japan relationship, has also gone through all sorts of vicissitudes, being very modest at first, suffering under discrimination, being imprisoned, but then miraculously turning into the model minority in the 60s and 70s. So the Japanese-American community also has had this kind of a story. One thing I'd like to stress here is the issue of relative power. Whenever you talk about U.S.-Japan relations or U.S.-China relations or U.S.-Mexico relations, it's assumed that there's an equality there, and formally and technically there is an equality. But one of the things that you look at when you see the U.S.-Japan relationship over the last 150 years is the relative power differential between the U.S. And Japan. The U.S. has always, in this situation, been the more powerful power. And Japan, in some ways, has always been, in a way, proactive and retroactive. Where it steps out of that is in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, where it tries to forge its own kind of future, often in opposition to the established empires of England and France and the United States. So it's the U.S. that usually takes the initiative in many cases, whether it's Commodore Perry or so on. So the Kanrin Maru has to be seen in that context as a response to what was American influence in that relationship. And you can tell I'm a professor here because I'm trying to give you all the nuances. Because you're talking about U.S.-Japan relations, you can't overlook all these other factors. Russia's a factor. China's a factor. Perry and the Americans, were they really interested in Japan? Well, they were interested. There were certainly some folks who were interested. They sent letters of petitions to President Fillmore and so on. But largely speaking, America was in rivalry with, at that time, the leading empire, England. And they wanted a slice of the China market. And so Japan was, in a way, a very convenient stopover point to the Big Apple. So you have to kind of see U.S.-Japan relations in a larger context of East Asian relations, U.S.-East Asian relations. Russia is not too far out of the picture. And even today, when we start talking about U.S.-Japan relations, China is always that big elephant in the room. You can't overlook it. It can't simply be defined as a U.S.-Japan bilateral situation. You also have to see the larger context of what it is. So that's the big picture. Let's talk about the little pictures here. Uh-oh, I think I... Here we are. Let me move this forward here a little bit. The U.S. begins to take the initiative in the 1850s when President Fillmore sends Commodore Perry with a fleet of eight vessels to Japan, which eventually eventuates in this Treaty of Kanagawa in 1854, which compelled the Japanese to open two treaty ports to the Americans. Now, the one that was probably more important than even the opening was this. The Treaty of Amity and Commerce of 1858. This, in a way, laid the basis for what was eventually going to become probably the most important part of this U.S.-Japan relationship. It's about money. It's about trade. It's about commerce. It's about people exchanging goods and services over time. And U.S. consul, Townsend Harris, was able to negotiate a very advantageous type of agreement with the Japanese at this time in 1858. So he had no military force, and this is another reason why we have to look at the larger context. How was Townsend Harris able to do this? He pointed to what the British were doing and the French were doing. What were the French doing in Indochina? They were creating an empire. What were the British doing in China? They were fighting the so-called Arrow War. And so Townsend Harris, our representative, our consul, simply said, look, I'll be the good cop. You make a deal with me, and we won't impose these terrible things that the French and the British are doing to the Chinese and to the Vietnamese. And so the Japanese said, well, this is fine. And so Townsend Harris's great carrot was, we're not going to impose the opium trade on you guys. We won't impose the kind of conditions that we do, for example, or the British have imposed on the Chinese. And the Japanese said, yes, let's do that. Let's do it. Let's do it the nice way. Let's not do it the hard way. So in addition to this, the Japanese opened a number of ports like Yokohama. Here we have some contemporary, and this, here we're going to get into a lot of the images, so I'll slow down in terms of the big picture but get involved in some more of the contemporary representations. Most of these are taken from a book published by Masao Miyoshi, As We Saw Them. This is a book that was published about 20 years ago. And the Japanese, of course, were very interested in what Americans were doing, and so they represented these various kinds of efforts. So this is Townsend Harris and Henry Hookson. Have any of you seen this old movie called the Geisha and the Barbarian? The Barbarian and the Geisha. It was a John Wayne movie made in 1958. It's still out there in Amazon.com. You can still get it. It's worth a chuckle because John Wayne, you know, gets dressed up in the top, the stovepipe hat. And at that time, they brought out Japan's leading starlet. Reiko Ando. I think her name was Ando. And so you have the barbarian and the geisha meeting, this kind of east meets west type of scenario. But the reality was really not that kind of Hollywood scenario, but really more negotiation, pretty hard negotiation. Mostly the shogunate didn't really want to deal with the Americans, but the Americans were very forceful, and they said, well, we could drive a harder bargain, or other countries will drive a harder bargain with you. One of the results of this was the development of the city of Yokohama, the port of Yokohama, in 1860, as you can see here. And the Japanese do a great job with these woodblock prints. You can see the incredible detail from all of this. And I think one of the reasons that artists spent as much time on this was, first of all, Americans were very, very novel. The foreign world was very novel. So this stuff sold well. In fact, it probably sold better than pornography, which is probably the best-selling trade in terms of like the wood, these woodblock prints. And so we have many, many of these woodblock prints available to us through through the artists of that particular time. So this gives you kind of a sense of the bustling activity. Now, you also have to see this in some context. At that time, maybe at the most, there were 200 to 400 merchants in Yokohama in that time, 1859, 60, 61, 62. So in the very early period, we're not talking about a lot of people, but, of course, Yokohama now is in the millions and so on. And some very these are somewhat idealized versions. Most American merchants were not necessarily there with their families, but here you have sort of a Leave It to Beaver kind of family, where you've got the hoop skirt, you know, which was something, but you know, this it looks kind of familial, but the reality was probably more like this. Young guys far away from home looking for a good time, and So there's also some of that. I don't necessarily need to show you more. I guess you can imagine what's going to happen here. But there's a lot of interest in this. There was a great deal of interest. And so these kinds of woodblocks sold very, very well. In some cases, they were fanciful. Some cases, they were idealized versions of what some Japanese might have thought Europeans or Americans looked like. In some cases, they were the extreme of that, where Americans were depicted as barbarians, sort of these Buddhist monsters. Now, it's at this crossroads in 1859 that the shogunate wanted to send. The shogunate was the samurai government established by the Tokugawa family in 1600, that they were going to send their very first delegation abroad. And part of it was to secure ratification of this treaty that had in some ways been foisted on them and kind of strong-armed by Townsend Harris. Maybe we can renegotiate this. You know, let's see if we can't do better. And so part of the arrangement for sending the Kanrin Mara was not merely to formally ratify this treaty, this new commercial treaty, but also to whittle away some of the unequal statuses, the unequal treaty status of many of these treaties that the Japanese were signing in the 1850s and 1860s. And now the Japanese really didn't have a ship to carry the they had forbidden long, you know, like a blue water fleet. They only had short-range coastal vessels. They didn't have anything really big, so they had to buy it from the Dutch. It was delivered in 1857. It's only 164 feet long. Speed, wow. Think about it. It was a hybrid, though. It had steam power, also sails. So it was the first Toyota hybrid. And it was basically really a coastal defense vessel. So the important part of this was Katsukaishu, who was eventually going to become the leading admiral of the Japanese Navy here. I'm sort of mixing my N's and L's here. I'm slipping into Japanese speak here. As captain of the vessel. And this is from one of my sources here, Wikipedia. So if you do Kanrin Maru, this is one of the earliest pictures of the Kanrin Maru as it actually looked like, rather than that artist's depiction of, you know, the big sails. And this is another artist's representation of this. This was in the winter, October, looks like, cold October. And so in that particular year, this is Katsukaishu. And he's one of the more important figures. He will become one of the most important figures of this regime change in China. And some of the important things, he was aboard the Kanrin Maru. He was the captain of the ship who came here. And he is a perennial favorite of NHK. They have these jidaigeki dramas. So you have these historical dramas in Japan. And so Katsukaishu always represents this dilemma of the traditionalists versus the modernists. You know, he has to kind of cope with all these stodgy guys, but he's always looking for something that's going to be new and modern. But he himself is kind of a traditional guy. So so there's this kind of dilemma always within the personality of Katsukaishu. So NHK and television dramas just love him because he's a bundle of all these kinds of contradictions. So this is the young Katsu. You can see him here. And eventually he has a rather impressive resume, trained as a Dutch translator. This was the foreign language that you were going to be trained in if you were going to know anything about the outside world. The Dutch were the only European country that you had access to in those days. He becomes one of the key promoters of Western ideas in Japan. That you need naval power, and one of the things that, of course, he was very keen on was promotion based on merit rather than on family. So he would not have been keen on George W. Bush becoming president of the United States. So much of what was happening in Japan was based on lineage, family pedigree, and things of this sort. So he wanted people to be assigned to positions of influence based on their merit and capability rather than on their family. Probably the most important situation, he's the man who arranges for the peaceful transfer of power. at Edo Castle in 1868. One of the reasons that the Japanese Civil War was not as bloody as the American Civil War between the Reformists and the Traditionalists was partly as a result of this man who makes the deal. Okay, let's do this nice. Let's not do this bad or badly. So I'm trying to paraphrase this. But he is he's a compromiser in many ways, and he leads Japan out of there. He's one of the forces, as well as Sakamoto Ryoma and people like that, who lead Japan away from the real depths of what a civil war can be. We all know what a civil war is in the United States. Japan avoids this at the same time in Japan. This is the Nagasaki Naval Training Facility at that time, headed up by Katsukaishu. This is a somewhat pixelated version from a Japanese textbook that I found about a year ago. And the star of the show, of course, is Fukuzawa Yukichi. I think I've seen more Fukuzawa images this year than any time in the past, because I've been to quite a number of these events talking about the Kanrinmaru and its significance. But Fukuzawa eventually becomes the most important figure aboard the Kanrinmaru ship here to the United States. And he becomes the key promoter of modern ideas. What are some of these modern ideas? Well, he's aboard the Kanrinmaru. He writes his autobiography. This is one of, I use this book myself for my students in modern Japan. And he becomes a million bestseller, I think, all of his works. And he writes extensively. He is very prolific. I think he sells something like 3 to 4 million copies. Now, Japan at that time had a total population of maybe 30 million people, 33 million, 35 million at that time. So if you're selling 3 to 4 million, a total, not one issue, and it ranged over his autobiography, history of Europe, history of civilization. I mean, he left no stone unturned. Nothing was too little or too big for him to write about. And people loved him. I think the message that I want to get out to you is that people love Fukuzawa because he was so open. He wanted to import all of these ideas. What were some of these ideas? Equality, liberty, capitalism. He's the founder of Keio University, Japan's first private university. He's the founder of Japan's first news service, news agency. And he's a commentator. I don't know how many of you have read Alexis de Tocqueville's letters to my countrymen, but de Tocqueville, of course, came to the United States in the 1820s, 1830s, and observed the life of the Americans, this new democratic experiment. De Tocqueville looked at it with some scorn. He talked about the tyranny of the majority. That's where you get the phrase, the tyranny of the majority, from de Tocqueville in his observations on America. But Fukuzawa was much kinder to America. America was the land of liberty. America was the land of democracy. America was the land of equality. So for him, America was really, in a way, the promised land, and he wanted so much of that to be transferred to Japan, which was feudal, isolated, agrarian, all of these kinds of things. So he becomes the great transmitter. He is, in a way, some scholars call him sort of this Enlightenment figure, like a Voltaire, like a Ben Franklin, in every way. And he was aboard this ship. He was very eager to see what America was like, what San Francisco was like. And he loved San Francisco. And what's there not to like? What's there not to like? Let's move ahead here. Oop. I think I ran out of... It's not advancing here. Well, maybe I could just...
Thank you.
Japan. This was the top currency. There's Fukuzawa's likeness, and then of course this is the older Fukuzawa. If you go to the National Diet Library image collection, this is the official, iconic Fukuzawa. Not the young man. He looks very serious, and so on. But the real Fukuzawa, he was always eager to see what life was all about. And this also is one of the more iconic photographs. Most of the people on the delegation didn't want to be photographed. Not only did Fukuzawa want to be photographed, he went to the photograph studio and found the daughter of the photographer. "Please, I'd like to take my picture with you." It's like, whoa. Facebook comes to Japan. That's right. That's right. You can sort of tell something about the body language here, but this was Fukuzawa. This is why people love Fukuzawa. You could really relate to Fukuzawa. Here he was in San Francisco. Of course, you'd want to be photographed by a local gal. So this is Theodora Alice, a very famous photograph here. Let me just, I think we're kind of, seeing a vehicle with horses attached to it, we should have easily guessed what it was, but really we did not identify our mode of conveyance. Until the door had been opened, we were seated inside and the horses had started off. Then we realized we were riding in a carriage behind horses. Oh my God! All of us wore the usual pair of swords at our sides and hemp sandals, so attired we were taken to the modern hotel. There we noticed the valuable carpets, which in Japan only the more wealthy could buy from importer shops, at so much a square inch to make purchases in tobacco pouches. But here the carpet was laid over an entire room! Something quite astounding. Upon this costly fabric walked our host wearing the shoes as they had come in from the streets. Oh my God. What is going on here? Immediately, bottles were brought in. Suddenly, an explosion. The popping of champagne. When the glasses were passed around, we noticed strange fragments floating in them. Hardly did we expect to find ice in the warm spring weather. Some of the party swallowed these floating particles. Others expelled them suddenly. Others bravely chewed them. This was an adventure. But finding out, it was ice. I'll end this particular paragraph. I wanted to have a smoke. But seeing no tobacco tray, such as in Japan, is placed before the smoker to hold the burning charcoal for zero and bamboo ashes here, I took a light from the open fireplace. Perhaps there was an ashtray and a box of matches on the table, but I did not recognize them as such. I finished my smoke. But finding no ash receiver, I took out some of the tissue paper which had carried in place of handkerchiefs, and wrapping the ashes in it, crushed them very carefully and placed the ball in my sleeve. After a while, I took out the paper to have another smoke. Wisps of smoke were trickling from my sleeve. The light that I thought I had crushed out was quickly setting me afire. This is why Fukuzawa sold millions. Yeah, he was a guy who knew how to write. You know, he could entertain you as well as inform you. He could go high, he could go low, he could go left, right, and everything like that. So that's just one example. Again, I don't want to overdo it. John Manzuro was one of the translators. Very difficult. I mean, how are you going to talk to each other? And yeah, this was one of the big problems. In fact, one of the reasons that Americans were kind of disappointed with the Japanese delegation at times because they couldn't speak English. And, you know, it was really hard. You had to pay a translator. And there were just a limited number of people who knew English. John Manzuro was one of them. And his story itself is an amazing story. He was as a young Japanese fisherman. Whoops, let's go back here. He's caught in the currents. He's out there, gets washed up, and he gets rescued by a U.S. whaling ship. There were whalers out close to Japan, of course. That's why they wanted this reciprocal exchange relationship with the Japanese at that time. Well, John Manjiro is picked up by this U.S. whaling ship, and he grows up in Fairhaven, Mass. He's a Massachusetts guy. He returns to the Ryukyu Islands in 1858 at the age of 24. As soon as the shogunate finds out he's been abroad, which is illegal, he gets put in prison for 2.5 years. What did you see? What did you do?
Are you a spy?
So finally he's assigned to the Kanrin Maru and becomes one of the translators for the group. So he's also one of the important figures. The official folks are these guys, Shimi Masaoki, Muragaki Norimasa, and Oguri Tadamasa. Now, they didn't want to go aboard the Kanrin Maru. That was a tiny, tiny ship. So they went aboard the Powhatan, which was a U.S. ship. You know, they wanted to make sure they got there.
So that's right. So the Kanrin Maru arrives here a couple of weeks before the Powhatan. And the Kanrin Maru was badly beaten up by all these storms. So they had to put in port up in Mare Island, up in Vallejo, and so on. But these are kind of more, these are a little more stiff, right? These are your official reps from the Japanese. What do they see? Well, this is a view of San Francisco Bay and the streets of San Francisco. Mare Island Naval Shipyard. These are all, and this is a photograph of the naval captain. The Americans were very kind and considerate and thought, well, since you've made all that trip, we're going to repair your ship for free. And so the sailors and everybody. Now, of course, eventually the group, except for the Kanrin Maru folks, stayed here went to Washington, D.C., and this is the procession to visit the president. And this is the official presidential reception. And the ambassadorial, the festival ball, presentation of American women. I'm kind of skipping over this quickly because I'm noticing my time and I don't want to take up too much of your time. Let me just maybe read a couple of, it's a very different kind of, I read to you from Fukuzawa, very different kind of style. This is from the official diary by Ambassador Shimi, okay? And he is astounded, for example, at a funeral at sea. There's an American sailor who dies, buried at sea. Captain shows up. He's astounded. Oh, my gosh. The captain shows up with a funeral of an ordinary seaman. We would never do that in Japan. Never, never, never. First day in Washington, D.C., we seated ourselves in the first carriage, which was drawn by four splendid horses, and the rest of the party followed. A long line of carriages was headed by a band, followed by two battalions of soldiers, and two more battalions brought up the rear. Bells in all directions were rung. We were amazed at the crowds of people that packed the streets. It was a surging sea of faces. This is very important. Japanese were very, very well received here. Very, very well received here. Every window was full, and there were spectators even on the roofs of the houses. Our procession went slowly every now and then. Was made in order to give all the thousands of eager spectators a chance of having a good look. On May 17th, this was the ceremonial meeting with the president. What immense crowds there were. The streets were like scenes of human beings. The windows and balconies were thronged with people eager to get a glimpse of the procession, so on and so forth. And on reaching the president's house, we were at once ushered into a large oval-shaped room, beautifully furnished, with a handsome carpet and curtains of considerable value. Large mirrors were on the walls, and tables of various sizes, in which a quantity of lacquerware goods and many other Japanese articles were tastefully displayed, were placed about the room. We were told that all the Japanese articles were presents to Commodore Perry. Sovereign. Before long, Secretary Cass came in and greeted us, accompanied by Captains DuPont and Navy, and so on and so forth. And then we're introduced to the audience room, and so on. And then he gives this talk, which is very, very brief and very formal. Except in the case of military and naval officers, you pay a lot of attention. Status, hierarchy, because they were in feudal society where everyone had their may become president. When his term of office expires, he retires again into private life. Contrary to what we had imagined, he does not own a princely castle or stately palace in which he resides. The house he lives in is not even his own. It is the property of the state, and he only occupies it while he is president. Of course, they're dancing. They're mortified. As I watched the various movements of the dancers, I could not help smiling at the way in which the very large skirts called crinoline, which the ladies wore, increased in volume until they became of enormous proportions. When the dancers attained their top speed, when one dance is over, the dancers go to the tables for drink and light refreshment, and then commence another dance. This continues until midnight. As for us, we had never seen or imagined anything like it before. It was, of course, of no small wonder that we witnessed this extraordinary sight of men and bare-shouldered women hopping around the floor, arm in arm. And our wonder at the strange performance became so great that we began to doubt whether we were not on another planet. I need not say, this is, I think, for the children, the rest here, I need not say that we did not remain until midnight. But after time, thanked our hospitable guests, our hosts, for the great entertainment, and returned to the hotel. And so they get taken to the Smithsonian, and they're horrified at what they think are the heads or scalps of people. They're the wigs. There are a lot of little things in this. Cute asides, but in some ways, probably the one that I'd like to read a little bit of you from is Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman is there in New York, I believe, where the Japanese reception, the Japanese group also went through this event. This is Walt Whitman, a Broadway pageant, 1860. And it's quite long. It's about 3 pages, so don't worry, I'm not going to read all of it to you. But this is on June 16, 1860. Oversea, hither from Nippon, courteous, the princes of Asia, swart-cheeked princes, first-comers, guests, two-sworded princes, lesson-giving princes, leaning back in their open barouches, presumably carriages, bareheaded and passive. This day they ride through Manhattan, libertad. I do not know whether others behold what I behold in the procession, along with the princes of Asia, the errand bearers, bringing up the rear, hovering about, around, or in the ranks marching. I will sing you a song of what I behold. Superb faced Manhattan, comrade Americanos, to us then, ambassador Lane comes. To us, my city, where our tall top marble and iron beauties range on opposite sides, to walk in the space between. Today, our antipodes comes. So on and so forth. And it's really a, you know, gosh, it's 1860s poetry by Walt Whitman. There's a lot of this, but so it's an event. It's a major event. What did I do with mine? And let me rush through this a little bit more rather than, there's a lot. Tommy was the star of the show. And here, this particular, the women of Japan adored him. The women of America adored him. Let's see. Tommy, Tateise Onegoro, was the pet of the ship, as he afterwards became of the ladies while in the United States. He was 17 and was the adopted son of Tokujiro, the second interpreter, by whom he was placed at the Dutch school of Nagasaki to learn the English language. He didn't speak English. Everybody loved him. After acquiring a very imperfect knowledge of the small vocabulary, he was brought to Yokohama. And given the situation as interpreter in the custom house, where his obliging disposition and peculiar, at the same time sociable manners soon made him so popular with the merchant's clerks who had to transact business at the custom house that the poor fellow was kept in a constant state of excitement by his untiring efforts to please everyone. So he's, you know, speak English. He was pleasant to get along with. He was definitely the star of the show. Group photograph at the Naval Yard, near Philadelphia. Of course, here's Broadway. This is what Walt Whitman was talking about in the Metropolitan Ball. And Now, the flip side to this was that as the Japanese, also as Americans, got to know more about Japan, and they also carried out these lurid tales of what, you know, public, not public, but private bathing, but mixed bathing. This is, for example, the first edition of Hawke's narrative of the expedition. This actually is right after Perry's visit to Japan in 53-54. So there's also stuff like this. Now, let me rush through some of this a little more quickly here. One of the things that does happen as a result of the visits is that Japan's elite becomes divided between the traditionalists and the modern Eventually, the modern called the Meiji Restoration. There are a lot of other things that are going on at this time. There are peasant rebellions, economic difficulties, a lot of dissatisfaction. The people who actually bring about this modernized society are lower-ranking samurai. They're not farmers, they're not peasants, they're not intellectuals. But they were samurai who never could really rise to any major positions of power because of where they were born in this caste society. And so part of the motivation for creating a more modern and equal society, like, say, Tokugawa Rikichi, was to create the possibilities of the social mobility. And so 1868... Meiji Restoration is like that. But there is fighting. Some of the local samurai fight the British and the Americans in 1863. But they also send many more people abroad, students from Choshu, southwestern Japan. And these were this is the last shogun, Tokugawa Yoshinobu, and the new emperor, Emperor Meiji Mutsuhito. This is, because he's a little bit older, this is not one of his earliest apologies, later also. So anyway, let me skip along with some of these. One of the things that does happen is that Japan escapes colonization in the 19th century. It's able to negotiate these various kinds of treaties with the foreign powers. It's also as a result of adopting these new ideas and being willing to try new things. It's the first Asian country to industrialize. But it also creates an empire, and that gets it into trouble with other more powerful imperial powers like the British, the French, and the Americans. Let's go on here. If you remember that first image that I showed you, this is the way the Japanese kind of viewed their first visit to the United States. Well, this is the Ishume Gambare no Hito. This is the person who can really do it. We're going to do it. We're going to do this. What do the Chinese do? What do the Chinese elite do? We're going to sit and look at the stars. So the Chinese built a beautiful marble boat. Probably many of you have seen it outside of Beijing in the Summer Palace. It's a very different kind of image. Both of them are iconic images. I'm not creating this out of, but when you think of 19th century China, this is often what you think of, complacency. You know, we have it, we don't need to worry about it. For the Japanese, we don't have it, we gotta find it, we gotta make it work. It's very, 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 very true. Now, of course, the two are somewhat different. One is in the 1890s, one is in the 1860s, so it's different in terms of 30 years, which is a generation. But I think it reflects the kind of mindset of the Japanese being open-minded and the Chinese being rather much more complacent about all of these things. Well, what are my bullet points? What are my main bullet points? And again, I'll try to keep it. I think both sides, both Japanese and Americans, have been very interested in each other. If you read all of these various documents, it's very true, whether you're talking about Walt Whitman or Fukuzawa Yukichi. And this kind of effort, I think, is still there. I mean, it's testimonial to the number of people who are here. I'm sure some of you are here for that good bento lunch. But I'm sure many of you could be down by AT&T Park trying to catch a quick glimpse of Tim Lincecum or somebody like that. So you're all here. You're interested in Japan, U.S.-Japan relations. So I really welcome that. It's really maintained this kind of level of enthusiasm. Now, I think if I could also be a little more nuanced as a professor here, I think overall the Japanese have been more interested in the U.S., and that's because of the power relationship. The U.S. is the bigger elephant. This elephant relationship. So the Japanese tend to have a lot more. Friendship here has a longer history than antagonism. I think I've mentioned this before. Mateo University and so many other things that are really very important. The friendship, the kind of ability of Fukuzawa to really, you know, be photographed with Alice in San Francisco. This is something. The third factor here, in terms of the next 150 years, if you're thinking about, well, we've done this for 150, where are we going in the next 150 or even the next 50? Again, as in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, China is a major factor in this. China's rising. China at that time was, in a way, a declining power. But you've got to, in a way, really integrate China into some kind of a peaceful stakeholder in this East Asian community. So that's a platitude, but I think that's the goal. How you get there, the bumps and everything like that. But you don't want to redo the wars of the early 20th century. You want to prevail upon more common sense to benefit. I think the Japanese American community also has gone through a lot. I haven't really spoken too much about this, but in a sense, the U.S.-Japan relationship also is a history of the Japanese American community. And right now, they're in a much better spot and place than they've ever been before, partly as a result of the small minority concept that emerges in the 70s. I'll end with a pious wish. A pious wish. And that is, the future should be better. But I think you need to build on the past. You need to build on this kind of history that's been developed between the U.S. and the Japanese. And build on the successes of the past and avoid the mistakes that have also happened. So, as in everything, Tim Lincecum also makes it boos and freezes. It's the real life. He doesn't strike everybody out. He ends up 3-4 runs. But he still comes out a winner. And Cliff Lee, I'm sure, will probably do a better job next time around, too. So you got to build on some success. So anyway, thank you for listening. So I... I promised Cynthia 45 minutes max, and I overdid that. So, but hopefully, you have questions, comments. Yes, sir.
Just a quick one, and then perhaps a deeper one. Who was the U.S. president at the time of the war?
Buchanan.
Was that Buchanan? And perhaps a more important one is, wasn't that mission, and I guess the subsequent Japanese contacts with the U.S. saw the tremendous discrimination against the Japanese Americans. How did that not come to factor into their view of the United States?
They see
that as a really undesirable aspect of these things which is wrong.
Yes, it is. It is. It happens on two levels. First of all, the unwillingness of Americans in some ways to accept Japanese, and as well as Chinese, various kinds of forms of discrimination, being able to buy land, but also at the higher levels where the Japanese are forced to sign or agree to things like Dublin's agreements where they would not permit this kind of immigration to come to the United States. So those are considered to be affronts. In addition to that, Wilson at the Versailles Peace Conference refuses to put in an anti-discriminatory kind of clause in Versailles. So this is one of the things that fed the resentment on the part of the Japanese elite, which in some ways led to World War II. In other words, it's one of the, they're really not taking this seriously. They don't really accept us as equals, even at the lower level, or even at a Wilsonian national self-determination level. Yeah, you can sort of figure maybe somebody off in the backwoods someplace can, may not have a wide open attitude to this. But at the very elite level, this was not true. So this fed resentment on the part of the Japanese elite, and certainly they protested very loudly, and let their own people know that too. The Japanese people. So it's a sad chapter of American history. It did not serve America very well. Yeah. Not just in terms of multiculturalism and some kind of platitude about multiculturalism, but in the sense of blowback, real blowback.
So I saw that one of
Hello?
Hi. Did I see that one of the persons, maybe Fukuzawa, took the Shogun side in the Civil War?
Fukuzawa was careful. He was a very careful man. The document that I read was his autobiography, which was written in the 1880s, early 1890s, just before a couple of years before he died. So he tends to romanticize some of the earlier period. But he was very careful and very cautious. Most of these people were. It's only after the Meiji Restoration that it was now okay to kind of come out and be a very open-minded reformer. Prior to that time, people kind of kept their cards close to the vest. So Fukuzawa also, as most of these people, Katsukaishu, for example, was one of the people who, and Sakamoto Ryoma, who tried to bridge these kinds of differences. The people who were most outspoken were people like Yoshida Shoin, who hated America, hated the West. These people have evil intentions toward us, and we need to fight them in every single way. Fukuzawa was a little more careful about that. You know, he wanted to see which way the wind is blowing. Another question? All right.
On the second one, in the 19th century when Japan was very much a rigid caste hierarchy, was the system any different? Was the social system in China, its major cultural influence on Japan, any different? Was it just as caste-bound? Were there more independent opportunities?
Well, it's a good question. I think it was more open in the sense of, at the very higher level, certainly the Manchus were the ruling family, and they dominated all positions. But at the local levels, if you were successful in the exam system, you could still qualify to become a mandarin or a higher level bureaucrat. So a lot depended on your skills in passing these bureaucratic exams based on Confucianism. So it was probably more open that way. In Japan, things were really rigid and fixed. There were some exceptions to the rule. In some cases, a family would have no male heir, and they would adopt. Adoption was fairly common. And even today, adoption is fairly common. So you would adopt, you know, if you didn't have that heir, you had to get a spare. So
I have a question. Maybe you mentioned it at the beginning. Maybe I didn't hear, but whose idea was it really to set up that first embassy to the United States? Is there one person in particular or a group of persons?
Well, it really is a good question. I remember reading this about a year ago, but it's a highly debated issue. And I think it was debated at the highest ranks. I think the man in charge of Japan at that time was Hotta Masayoshi. And he was probably the person who actually gave the yes to this. He was more willing. He thought that it would be better to negotiate a bad agreement than not to negotiate anything and face a war. And so this was kind of the lesser of the two evils. It's like, you know, do you vote for Barbara Boxer or do you pick Carly? You know, you may not like either one, but Barbara looks better than Carly, maybe. And so Hotta had to make that decision for Japan. So I think it was Hotta Masayoshi who actually did that. Yeah, he was a realist, and I think he served Japan well.
And what was his function in the?
Hotta Masayoshi, I think, was called Roju. He was the chief advisor to the shogun. You know, if I remember my history here, but you're really putting me on the spot here.
Sorry.
Yes.
What was the role of Russia in the beginning of this relationship?
Russia was right around the margins of this. There were a number of groups headed by a member named Putyatin, who also was like a Perry who visited, went to Edo and then later to Nagasaki. But the Russians were very interested in this, and the Japanese were actually in some ways even more afraid of the Russians than they were of the Americans, because the Russians were right next door. And the areas of Hokkaido and the Northern Islands were contested. and undefined. And so one of the reasons, after the Meiji Restoration, the Japanese government tries to define those borders, first of all by establishing Okinawa and eliminating the Ryukyu Kingdom in the south, and then also taking over Hokkaido in the north. Both of these are done in the 1870s. So they become, scholars call them internal colonies. I didn't want to say that, but yeah. But they officially become part of modern Japan as prefectures. But even today, they're, you know, if you travel to Hokkaido, they're kind of, they don't have the Shinkansens, the bullet trains. You know, you have to kind of, you don't have to quite go with dog sleds, but they're not quite, you know, they haven't gotten the kind of the TLC that some of the other prefectures will get. And, of course, Okinawa has been turned into an American military launching pad with, I'm sure all of you follow the newspapers about the reluctance on the part of Okinawa people to accept the American military bases there. So these have been stepchildren. Really from the 1870s. There are lots of issues here with them, but in my opinion, at least.
The delegation was in San Francisco for at least a month.
So a long time, yes.
A long time. What did they do, and who did they meet with, and where did they stay?
Oh, well, let's see. I think some of them stayed in Vallejo. Some of them stayed in hotels. I think they were hosted in various places. They actually were met with the governor of California at the time, I think they mostly stayed in their hotel. Some of them were more adventurous, like Fukuzawa Yukichi, but people brought them fish, gave them special baths, you know, got arranged for baths for them, you know, just the very mundane kind of things. So they were very appreciative of being kind of welcomed here with some of the same amenities that they would have expected back there. Oh, and of course, visiting women. Sure. Yeah. Of course. Of course. How could I forget? These are guys far away from home. They were curious. Japanese women are much better. That was their conclusion. It's better at home.
Any other questions? If not, please join me in thanking Gildas Cruz.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again. You're welcome. And thanks again to the Kanrin Maru 150th Anniversary Committee for our lunches today and the Japan Society of Northern California, as well as the Japanese American Chamber of Commerce. Thank you all again for coming. Hope to see you at another program soon.